Welcome to EAN Cast, your weekly source for education, research, and updates from the European Academy of Neurology.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to our weekly EAN podcast. My name is Barbara Tettenborn. I am the editor-in-chief of eLearning, and besides that, the head of Department of Neurology in St. Gallen, Switzerland. On my side for today's podcast is Professor Yildiz Deghiamenci, who is a member of the eLearning Editorial Board and a movement disorder specialist herself. Hello, Yildiz. Maybe you introduce yourself shortly.
Hi, Barbara, and thank you for this kind introduction. I'm very delighted to be here with you as a co-moderator today and with our special guests for sure. As you mentioned, I'm a member of the EAN eLearning Editorial Board and the Movement Disorder Scientific Panel of EAN. I'm a movement disorder specialist running the neurology unit of the Parkinson's Disease and Movement Disorder Center in Medipol University, Istanbul, Turkey.
Thank you, Yildiz. This month, as you know already, our EAN cast has movement disorders as topic of the month. In the first episodes, we heard a lot about diagnosis and treatment of Parkinson's disease, and today we are talking about atypical Parkinsonism. Our today's guests are Associate Professor Georg Kägi and Assistant Professor Florian Brugger. Georg Kägi is Vice Chair of the Department of Neurology at St. Gallen Hospital. He is Deputy Chair of the Swiss Movement Disorders Society and Board Member of the Swiss Parkinson Association. Florian Brugger has the co-lead of the Movement Disorder Clinic in our hospital in St. Gallen. Both completed a two-year Movement Disorder Fellowship at Queen Square in London. We are very happy that you found the time for our podcast today for joining us. Welcome, Georg and Florian.
Hello. Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you as well.
So I think we start with our questions, and I will ask Georg first a few questions. Say, just for the start, I would like to talk about the definitions and clinical features. Could you shortly explain what atypical Parkinsonism is? Is it identical with Parkinson plus, or are these different entities?
So I think if we talk about atypical Parkinsonism, I think it's very important to know typical Parkinsonism. So idiopathic Parkinson's syndrome, I think we have to know all the faces and phenotypes of Parkinson's disease to be able to talk about atypical Parkinsonism. And also, I think it's important not only to look at the motor features, but also no motor features. We can also be very helpful in differentiating different typical from atypical Parkinsonism. And the designation atypical refers to poor levodopa response of Parkinsonism and early manifestation of additional clinical features. So this, and there comes the Parkinson plus word, such as ophthalmoparesis, dysautonomia, apraxia, or dementia. And in this webcast, we're not talking about secondary causes of Parkinsonism, like drug-induced Parkinsonism or structural lesions causing Parkinsonism. So, and then we're coming to the atypical Parkinsonian syndromes, and a couple of very good clinical neurologists in past century have described these entities. They're sporadic, this is important, and the definite confirmation is ex vivo. So in vivo, we only have diagnostic criteria. And one group belongs to the tauopathies, which is progressive supranuclear palsy and corticobasal degeneration, or better, corticobasal basal syndrome, because there's a big overlap. And the second is our synucleinopathies, which is multiple system atrophy and Lewy body dementia. And then the problem with the advances with genetics, we see that many genetic conditions can mimic atypical Parkinsonism. For example, Kufor-Rakeb or Paris syndrome with Parkinsonism and vertical gaze palsy. And so how should we call them? So I think they don't belong to the classical atypical Parkinsonian syndrome. There are also there's a paper which calls them atypical Parkinsonian syndrome. So it's getting complicated, but I think the podcast today is about the really typical atypical Parkinsonian syndromes, progressive supranuclear palsy, corticobasal syndrome, multiple system atrophy, and Lewy body dementia.
That's a nice expression, typical, atypical. I haven't heard that before. So how, if you want to describe it in a few words, how does the atypical Parkinsonism differ from idiopathic Parkinsonism or Parkinson's syndrome?
I think the hallmark of all atypicals is that the response to levodopa is absent or poor or rapidly waning. So this is, I think, what they have in common. The tempo of the disease progression is usually much faster. Although we know from the Queen Square Brain Bank that there are MSAP patients or PSP patients who live 20 or even longer. So also here, there's a big range. But usually, poor response to levodopa, fast progression, that's very clear. And then for PSP, for example, that's what also gives the name to this disease is the oculomotor findings, the vertical gaze palsy, which is more specific. If it's down gaze, but earlier symptom, and then slow saccades, falls, and also cognitive impairment. PSP doesn't have hyposmia, for example, or doesn't have REM sleep behavior disorder, which can be very helpful at the beginning in differentiating it from Parkinson's disease. And then we have the corticobasal syndrome. When I was at Queen's Quay, we called that still corticobasal degeneration, but we are a bit scared because pathology is so heterogeneous. So I think we rather stick to corticobasal syndrome, which is defined as a marked asymmetry with rigidity, spasticity, dystonia, abnormal posture of the arm, of a leg, apraxia, and myoclonus, and cognition is also very early impaired. And then MSA is also poor liver responsive Parkinsonism or ataxia combined with very early and marked dysautonomia. So this is different to idiopathic Parkinson's syndrome. The patient really says, from this month, my bladder is going to be incontinent, or they have really symptomatic orthostatic hypotension, or erectile dysfunction is also early and pronounced. Cognitively, they're very sharp. This is often contrasting the striking physical disability. And Lewy body dementia is a part of definition that dementia is present from early on.
So thanks for this detailed answer. But since the differential diagnosis of patients with Parkinsonism symptoms is so crucial in the clinical settings to establish a proper diagnosis and treatment as well, would you please summarize for us again the red flag findings during the assessment of a patient, which may suggest a possible diagnosis of atypical Parkinsonisms, especially for our young listeners?
Yeah. So I think for young colleagues, I think we should always think about atypical Parkinsonism, but especially if there's no response to levodopa, and if I say no response to levodopa, I mean really 1,000 milligrams or even more. So don't stop with 300 or 400. It doesn't prove poor levodopa response. And then the disease dynamics. So if you think about Parkinson's disease, it starts typically in one hand, and then 1 year later, maybe the leg drags a little bit, and 1 or 2 years later, the other side is getting a little bit involved. And within the first 5 years, you don't see falls and all this. And this is pretty different in atypical disease. So you have it much faster. You have falls in PSP maybe within 1 year, in MSA within the first 3 years. And so this is certainly one very important red flag. And then we have the gait, which is, I think there's a nice study also about just tandem gait, irrespective of what atypical Parkinson's disease you face. When the Parkinson's disease patient with Parkinson's disease is usually able to do a tandem gait without sidesteps, and atypical Parkinsonism often can't do this from very early on. So about 15% are able to do this when you see them first in clinic. So very simple test, and very good. Then don't forget the eyes, oculomotor examination, PSP. In very early stage, you might see, you already see square wave jerks or some slowing of vertical saccades or around the houses sign before really you have the gaze palsy. That's an important red flag for PSP. And of course, early falls and postural instability. Then for both PSP and CBS, this might be the cognition, which can start early. For CBS, apraxia and myoclonus. So the problem is when you see this arm with dystonia, rigidity, maybe a bit of spasticity, how am I going to test apraxia? So it's very difficult, but use the other hand, the hand which is still working very nice, and you see that the apraxia, you will find there apraxia as well. And for MSA, I think it's dysautonomia. It's very important. So you don't have to send the patients to a very fancy lab. You can do a proper test like lying, standing. So do it as you should. And there are clear criteria. Also look at the bladder. The new criteria for MSA are I think, a bit better for this respect. If you have inspiratory stridor, this is very specific for MSA, and you might also see polymyoclonus of the hands. These are a bit my gallery of red flags for atypical Parkinsonism.
Yeah, I also found that very informative to have these red flags. And you mentioned several names of syndromes. So maybe now we switch for a short while to Florian. And we have heard so many syndrome names included within the typical atypical Parkinsonism. How could we define a corticobasal syndrome?
So Georg already provided some insights into the clinical spectrum of CBD. And one important issue here is to distinguish between cortical basal syndrome and cortical basal degeneration. So the term syndrome refers to a combination of clinical signs, which is typical for this entity. And the CBS is defined as a progressive disorder, at least for more than 1 year, at the age of 50 or older than 50 years. And for sporadic cortical basal syndrome, we must not have any family history or no mutation. And there are several diagnostic criteria. They refer to the red flags, which Georg already mentioned. So first, we have to have a asymmetric akinetic rigid syndrome, so Parkinsonism, either in combination with dystonia or myoclonus or either of them alone. And in combination with orobuccal or limb apraxia, cortical sensory deficits or an alien limb phenomenon. And apart from these rather technical definitions, we often see other clinical signs as, for example, signs of the first motor neuron or myoclonus is part of the definition, and also frequent falls already in the early stage and earlier than in PD. As I mentioned before, we have to distinguish between the pathological term cortical basal degeneration and cortical basal syndrome. And the pathological hallmarks of CBD are seen in the CBS, so in the clinical picture, but also in PSP, in the PSP phenotype, but also in a behavioral variant of disorder, and also in non-fluent variant of progressive aphasia. So we have an overlap in the clinical syndrome, which are all caused by cortical basal degeneration. And on the other hand, we have the problem that the cortical basal syndrome might be caused by a typical Alzheimer pathology or PSP pathology. So the CBS is actually the clinical phenotype of a different pathological entities. And these are the challenges also for the clinical workup, to that we cannot strictly correlate the clinical syndrome with a clear pathology, particularly not in CBS.
And so, since we talked about progressive supranuclear palsy in defining and determining the CBS cortical basal syndrome also, would you please tell us more about the diagnostic criteria of the PSP and which variants of PSP do exist?
So there are also diagnostic criteria for PSP by the Movement Disorder Society, published 5 years or so ago. And the term PSP also refers usually to a sporadic disorder in patients older than more than 40 years of age, and it's also a gradual progressive disorder. And we have different levels of certainty in this diagnostic criteria. So we have the certainty of pathology, which is the definite diagnosis of PSP and PSP pathology. But we also have probable, possible PSP and suggestive of PSP. And these levels of certainty are defined by the by different core features, so oculomotor abnormalities like vertical gaze palsy, slowing of the vertical gaze saccades or muscarinic jerks as well. Then we have the core feature of postural instability within 3 years after the first symptoms, so falls and the inability to resist to a retropulsion. And we have the Parkinsonism, so the akinesia, the rigidity, and also cognitive disorder or dysfunction like speech problems or frontal behavioral symptoms. And in addition to these core features, which according to the severity of these features, we have also, which define the level of certainty, we also have supportive features. So the levodopa resistance is also supportive of PSP, and we also have imaging features which might support the diagnosis of PSP. And then we have different subtypes, so depending on the predominance of one of these core features. So the classical phenotype is the Richardson syndrome with postural instability and vertical gaze palsy and the early falls. But we also have presentations where the oculomotor features are more prominent than all the other features, and this is the main feature there. We have pure akinesia and gait freezing presentation, which is defined by a freezing for more than or for up to 3 years before other symptoms present. Or we have also more frontal behavioral presentations in combination with only mild symptoms of like oculomotor features, and also these overlaps with cortical basal syndrome, and also again some overlap with speech variants, so the non-fluent variant of the progressive aphasia. And so these entities are also considered in the new diagnostic criteria, but there are also some overlaps seen with motor neuron affection or also a cerebellar subtype, where we can see very prominent, for example, nystagmus or gait ataxia.
Thank you, Florian. To continue with the multiple system atrophy, would you please briefly summarize for us the diagnostic criteria of MSA and also the variants of MSA that we see in the clinical settings?
Mm-hmm. So quite recently, there was also a publication with a new MDS diagnostic criteria, which require an age of onset at 30 years of age or older than that, a negative family history, and it should be also progressive disorder as all the other atypical Parkinsonism forms. So the core features are Parkinsonism, again defined as an akinetic rigid syndrome, or cerebellar syndrome. So this is a different core feature, the cerebellar syndrome. And then we have prominent autonomic features like urinary disturbances, incontinence, or the urinary retention, or cardiovascular autonomic failure defined as an autonomic hypotension. And so the combination of these core features defines the MSA, and we also have some supportive features like postural deformities, so the lack reflection or Pisa syndrome, or prominent stridor, which support the diagnosis but which are not essential for the diagnosis of MSA. And again, like in the other criteria, we have different levels of certainty. So the definite diagnosis is made by neuropathology. And then depending on the combination, how many core features we see, we also have a clinically established MSA, a clinically probable MSA, or prodromal MSA. And so we have different operating definitions which can use depending on either whether you're doing research or for clinical diagnosis. So we have different subtypes. The one group is the MSAP subtype, where the Parkinsonian features are the most prominent features. And then we have the MSAC subtypes where we have the cerebellar signs as the most prominent motor features, and again in combination with the autonomic failure. There are two subtypes in MSA, so we have MSAP, the Parkinsonian variant, where the Parkinsonian signs are the most prominent motor signs, and we have the MSAC subtype, where the cerebellar signs are the most prominent motor signs.
Thank you very much for these very nice insights into all the typical and atypical signs of atypical Parkinsonism. And now we come to the diagnostic tools. Georg, could you please give us some clues about the new imaging findings supporting PSP and MSA that would also help to differentiate these disorders from idiopathic Parkinson's disease?
Absolutely. So I first want to highlight the importance of the history. So I learned the sentence, if you don't know the diagnosis after taking the history, go back and take it again. I think it's very important in these diseases, really, because this is really the major findings, and then the clinical comprehensive investigation. And then we're coming to neuroimaging. And neuroimaging has a little bit of a problem in the clinical routine, that in a bit advanced stages, we might find pretty clear findings. So let's see, in PSP, we see this midbrain atrophy with all these nice signs with colibri and morning glory and how they're all called. But in the very first part of the disease, the first 6 months, where we have subtle clinical signs, we might not see this in the normal MR. And the same is true for MSA, the C type. We might see the cerebellar atrophy, but at very early on, it might already still be subtle. There is a very specific sign, the MCP sign, the middle cerebellar peduncle sign. When we see it, it's helpful, but at the beginning, we might not see it. And then in the MSAP type, we see this hot cross bond sign, but this is already also, again, in the more advanced stages and putamenal rim sign. And so I personally haven't seen it in the very early stage of disease. So clinical findings are as important as imaging findings. But of course, it's important to rule out symptomatic causes. And again, in CPS, again, parietal atrophy is usually seen a bit later on. Then we have this nuclear medicine investigations. That scan is not really useful because it's not able to differentiate between idiopathic and atypical, at least in the daily routine. In scientific work, it might have some discriminatory abilities. And also this PET imaging, rectal pride, this postsynaptic imaging, IBZM SPECT, the MIBG heart SPECT, FDG PET. It also may be a puzzle, the piece in the puzzle, but I think it's not diagnostic by itself. Autonomic testing is very important. Sleep studies can be very helpful. If you have REM sleep behavior disorder, you're usually not dealing with PSP or CBS. The CSF might be helpful in tauopathies, and formal really good oculomotor testing by a neuro-ophthalmologist also might also be adding up very well.
Thank you very much, and also for emphasizing again the importance of the clinical examination. I think that's very important, especially for the young ones, that you don't order the imaging first. Just look at the patient carefully, do the clinical examination, and then decide what to do on top.
So now I believe that we get to the treatment options for the atypical Parkinsonism syndromes. I'd like to ask Florian to give us some clues about that. What can we offer to the patients? How does the therapy of atypical Parkinsonism differ from the treatment of idiopathic Parkinsonism?
So one crucial point in atypical Parkinsonism is the lack of response to levodopa, as Georg mentioned in the introduction. Nevertheless, we still try a trial of levodopa for, let's say, 3 months with at least 1 gram to see whether patients respond. And there's a small proportion of patients, for example, with PSP, who have a mild or transient response, and we should use this response to provide some quality of life to them. then apart from the treating the dopaminergic deficit in this atypical Parkinsonian disorder, we can focus on symptomatic treatment of the non-motor features. So, for example, in MSA, we focus on the autonomic features, urinary disturbances. We have a lot of sleep problems in some of these entities. Then we focus on them with, for example, when it comes to treating REM sleep behavior disorder. Then we try clonazepam, for example. There's a large list of drugs which you can use, and they all mention different guidelines. And one main difference also to Parkinson's disease, that it's the surgical treatments are not feasible in this group of Parkinsonian disorders. So we can't use deep brain stimulation or any lesional procedure to provide any help. So there's no evidence that at this stage to support any of these treatments.
Okay, speaking of autonomic dysfunctions in MSA, that can be extremely challenging for clinicians. Can you tell us more about the algorithmic approach to manage autonomic dysfunction symptoms in MSA, please?
So one main group of autonomic symptoms are those related to orthostatic hypertension. And so in the first step, we always review the drugs and look whether there are any drugs which have the potential to lower the blood pressure. So then we have to remove these drugs in the first step. We have several non-pharmacological treatments like fitting compression stockings or abdominal binders, and to recommend patients to take enough salt or to drink enough fluid to have a increased intravasal volume. And if these measures are not sufficient to increase the blood pressure to a sufficient high level, then we go for pharmacotherapy. We can use alpha-adrenergic agonists like midodrine or droxidopa, which is a norepinephrine precursor drug if it's available in your country. And we also can increase the intravasal volume with fludrocortisone. With regard to urinary disturbances, which are another core feature in MSA, we again have to review the drugs. So there are some drugs which might increase the urinary hesitancy or the urge for urination. And so we can remove these drugs as well if it's reasonable from other medical aspects. And then we have two different patterns of urinary disturbances. We have symptoms of overactive bladder. Then we can use anticholinergics or also beta adrenergic drugs like mirabegron. When we on the other hand side have retention of urine, we can go for alpha blocker, which again might cause problems on the orthostatic hypertension side. And if these measures are not enough for satisfactory urination, we have to go for intermittent catheters or permanent catheters to avoid any residuals in the bladder and to avoid any superinfections of the urine which is retained there. Then we also see erectile dysfunction. So in MAID, you can go for the usual drugs like sildenafil. Often patients complain about constipations. You can, again, use non-pharmacological measurements like high enough fluid intake or a fiber diet. And you can also use stool softener to give some relief from the constipation side.
Thank you, exactly, because you gave so many take-home messages for our young listeners especially. And since we are coming to the end, can you briefly summarize the possible treatment options in corticobasal syndrome, please?
So again, in CBS, we have the problem that the motor symptoms do not sufficiently respond to levodopa, but still we always do a trial of levodopa to see if there's at least some amount of response. Then we also have the issue of apraxia, and this makes it even more difficult to have some relief from the Parkinsonian side because the apraxia might blur any benefit from levodopa. Then another issue in CBS is often the quite prominent dystonia, which you can treat with botulinum toxin injections. Usually you need higher doses because there are also some components of spasticity as well in the affected limb. When it comes to speech and language problems, you can go for speech therapy. to at least stabilize the decline of the language skills. In dementia, you can use occupational therapy or a praxis component of the CBS, or you can also try pharmacotherapy like acetylcholine esterase inhibitors.
Maybe as a final question, are there any disease-modifying drugs on the horizon?
So I think the horizon is the correct term. So we are not yet there to provide any disease-modifying drug at this stage. So there are efforts in slowing down the different forms of atypical Parkinsonism. They target the abnormal proteins which are deposited in the cells, in so either tau in CBS or PSP, or alpha-synuclein in MSA. So different strategies like small molecules which avoid the aggregation of alpha-synuclein, for example, or immunization strategies. So several of these approaches are under examination in clinical trials, but I think we have to be patient, and it's still too early to give patients a hope for the next few years.
Okay, I think we all received a whole lot of information about atypical Parkinsonism today. I thank you a lot for taking your time and giving all these informations on the disease. Thank you, Georg. Thank you, Florian. And thank you, Yildiz, for accompanying me in the moderation of today's podcast. And we hear you again in a week's time on the EAN cast of next week. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye. This has been EAN Cast Weekly Neurology. Thank you for listening. Be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred podcatcher for weekly updates from the European Academy of Neurology. You can also listen to this and all of our previous episodes on the EAN campus to gain points and become an EAN expert in any of our 29 neurological specialties. Simply become an EAN individual member to gain access. For more information, visit ean.org/membership. That's ean.org/membership. Thanks for listening. EAN Cast Weekly Neurology is your unbiased and independent source for educational and research-related neurological content. Although all content is provided by experts in their field, it should not be considered official medical advice.